Welcome to Tales from the Fourth Trimester, a podcast dedicated to the beauty and brutality of new motherhood. I'm your host, Naomi Chrysalakis, and I'm a postpartum doula and cook in Sydney, Australia. My service, Cocoon, provides good food and a helping hand for new mamas. Join me as I chat to women about what happened after they brought their baby home and interview experts for their wisdom. Because giving birth is just the beginning. I'm talking to Kyra Warden today. Kyra had a career where she helped women through some of the hardest things that you could go through during pregnancy, birth, and beyond. She was a social worker who specializes in working with pregnant women and new mums. So she was really exposed to kind of a ton of worst case scenarios and how things can, you know, fall apart, go wrong medically, socially, you know, relationship wise. And she talks in this podcast about how that impacted on her pregnancy and how she was able to, in some ways, use her social work knowledge to apply to her own situation, but how in other ways it really didn't help. So I think this is a really interesting one for anyone who has gone through any kind of birth injury or trauma. If you're in health services, you know, Kyra talks really eloquently around how healthcare workers just have a different way of looking at things. And I'm not a healthcare worker, but I can absolutely appreciate what she's saying around. It's almost like when you know too much, it's like you know the things that can go wrong, and that has a real impact. So thank you, Kyra, for sharing, and I hope you all enjoy this episode. I've got Kyra Warden with me today. Kyra, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
No worries.
It's really nice to talk to you because I feel like we've been having a bit of like an Instagram DM back and forth since way before you had your baby, and now you've got a 3-month-old, is that right?
She's 4 months on Sunday.
Wow. So tell everyone a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so I'm Kyra. I'm a social worker, and I've spent a good part of my career being a maternity social worker. And recently I moved from a big city and came back to my small hometown in northern New South Wales to have a family, and had my little baby girl in January. So lots going on in the world in January. It's a weird year to have a baby.
Absolutely. God, so the bushfires would have still been all well and truly happening in January.
And then I live rurally, so I had to evacuate.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll get to that. I want to hear about that.
But yeah, bushfires, floods, pandemic, you name it.
Can you explain to everyone a little bit more about what it is you do for work and some of the day-to-day situations you have to deal with?
Yeah, so social work in general is really, really broad, but obviously for the context of the podcast, I think maternity social work, which is also like my main passion. So women's health is where I love working. I worked in a big tertiary hospital. So that's like a big teaching hospital where a lot of the critical cases are sent. So there's lots of social workers in big hospitals like that. And maternity social workers basically are there to try and enhance mothers and babies' well-being. So to assist you with your experience of health. We're called Allied Health, but I suppose we're the only probably staff members, us and psychologists, who aren't thinking in completely medical terms. So we're doing the holistic, like who's at home, who's this impacting, how do you feel about it, trying to see you as a person rather than obviously the medical professionals. It's really important that they keep medicine at the forefront, but we let them do that and we try and look after everything else that might be affecting someone. So it ranges really from a diagnosis in pregnancy, so something going on in pregnancy health-wise that may require admission or extra appointments, or may just be a huge adjustment. So it's never nice to find out in pregnancy if you're, you know, experiencing anything like a maternal health issue, or there's something going on with Barb, or anything that's not, you know, I'd put this in quotes, but out of the norm or what you might expect. And then all the way through to things that aren't medical, so life circumstances, so financial distress, domestic violence, even just like employment and housing and relationship dynamics. And then on the other side of things, once Bub's born, things like admission to NICU, so preemie babies, really sad stuff like death of a baby, or sometimes we will deal with child protection issues and adoption. And so there's a big, really big range of what we do. So if it's kind of causing you stress, we're there.
And thank goodness for that. That work is amazing. And I take my hat off to you, because that is intense work, I'm sure, as well, and very emotional work at times.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely is. But I think recently as well, hospitals have begun, well, health systems in general have begun to include allied health, because I know that for a lot of people, thinking of social workers in a hospital, automatically they think, what have I done wrong? This is about child safety or child protection. And it's quite often not. I mean, there's so much that we do that's not child protection. And I would say, you know, if there's a chance to see a social worker in the hospital, definitely for anyone who needs one or is just a bit concerned, it's the best sort of starting point for anything that's going on. But yeah, it can be really, really emotional work, really stressful. There's a lot of vicarious trauma. But that's kind of part of the job.
So when you were thinking about starting a family, how much did your job impact on that sort of period of your life of thinking about it and getting ready?
Yeah, heaps. So I'd been thinking about starting a family for a little while, but when I was still actually working in the hospital in the maternity ward, I found it really hard to even wrap my head around the idea that I could have a pregnancy that wouldn't be like the people I was seeing. So I think there's lots of literature on it, but essentially when you're exposed to a lot of trauma, or when you're exposed to a certain amount of chaos, I suppose, you normalize that. So you think that the things that are maybe one in 500 chance of happening, you'll be seeing 10 of those a day. So you just assume that that's what will happen. And social workers do quite a lot of work. You know, we do lots of our own debriefing and trying to avoid vicarious trauma. But I suppose it's kind of unavoidable. Like there's no amount, I feel quite strongly about, there's no amount of like self-care for anybody that can, you know, humans are bound to absorb some of the trauma they're exposed to. So there's no amount of self-care and debriefing and looking after your mental health that can ever completely protect you from thinking like that. So it took me a while. And then once I ended up moving down this way and doing a bit of community work for a while, and that's when I felt pregnant. And I had to really put a lot of effort into trying to experience the pregnancy as just a normal person, like someone who didn't know what could go wrong.
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, that is, in a way, ignorance is bliss. And sometimes you can know too much. How did your partner feel about the whole thing? Was he more easy breezy about it than you? Just a different perspective?
Yeah, so that definitely helped. He was very excited from day one. So once I got that, you know, the positive test result, he was so excited. And I was like, we have to wait till 12 weeks. Nothing is for sure after until then, you know.
You know the rates of miscarriage.
Exactly. And I think every day I would be quoting, well, it goes down to this percent today. I was a little bit obsessive. I'd say the first 12 weeks were the hardest for me. in that thinking. So my partner was really useful because he would say, no, like it's really exciting. I just want to be excited. And I was also excited, but that sort of, well, this could go wrong. It's okay if that goes wrong because that's quite common. And, you know, just trying to social work myself, but that's not possible. So I did let go of that, but he was really useful and he came along with me. We did, we went full, like I did hypnobirthing and avoided negative birth stories and just tried really hard to sort of recondition my thinking.
And you were working throughout the pregnancy, I assume?
Say that again, sorry.
You were working throughout the pregnancy?
Yes, but in a different environment, so in less maternity, yeah.
That sounds like a good thing. That's okay. So how was your pregnancy other than that ever present knowledge?
Well, it sort of slowly go away. I even went to antenatal classes, and just pretended that I didn't know, you know, any of that information, and it was quite refreshing. So I eventually got to the point where I got that out of my head, but my pregnancy was actually awesome. So physically, I was so lucky. Nothing went wrong. Like, I mean, I just couldn't, like every day I'd be like, nothing's gone wrong. You know, but like I didn't even really get morning sickness. And I assumed I'd have hyperemesis. So like everything that happened, I was like, oh my God, this is very lucky. Is it real? Or maybe I'm not pregnant, you know, because I knew about, you know, nauseas because of the hormones and maybe I didn't have enough hormones. So, but yeah, it was really good. I was very lucky. But I'm sure this is true for anyone, but whilst I was really lucky physically, there's still a lot of emotional stuff that happens when you're pregnant. And so that, even though I knew about that, it didn't protect me from having to experience it. So I know you've talked about it before with guests, but certainly that adjusting to the physical changes and my body changing and the way I look changing and just like, who is this new person? And being like sort of public property, I found that really challenging. Mm. But yeah, physically I had a really straightforward pregnancy.
Hmm. Well, that's great. It sounds like there was a fair amount of anxiety there through it. Did you ever worry that you had prenatal or perinatal anxiety?
Yeah, definitely. And I've done a lot of work with a lot of women around that. And I mean, that's the other thing is I was constantly kind of evaluating, is this reasonable anxiety? Is it not? And, you know, thinking, well, in a way it's reasonable because I know this can happen and I'm only reacting because I know this can happen. But probably around maybe 4 or 5 months, I really made a lot of rules for myself in terms of boundaries of anxious thinking, which really helped. And I got to a point where I actually sort of really just trusted the process. And so a lot of that, you know, that hypnobirthing thinking, like my body's designed to do this, I can do it. Once I'd had a few positive scans, I could start sort of saying, all of the information is that there's nothing wrong with the baby. All of the information, like, what do I know now? And sort of stating the facts and that kind of thinking. So I used a lot of the stuff I'd had before. And I also, social workers often have like a supervisor or like an external psychologist that we debrief with. So I made sure to see mine along the pregnancy as well to just kind of keep a lid on, you know, have I lost my ability to see reason. But I think it's interesting, isn't it, like often when we experience anxiety we can overthink the anxiety. Like if we've got a little bit of insight we get anxious about, am I anxious, like am I, so I think there's a fair amount of anxiety that's normal in pregnancy.
Yes.
So it's that balance of trying to determine what's normal and what's not.
Absolutely. I mean, I someone said something to me the other day, which I was like, oh, that's quite true. It's like worrying is kind of the work of the pregnant woman. That's just sort of part of the process. I'm curious to hear a little bit more about, you mentioned that you put some boundaries in place around the anxious thoughts. What did that, tell me a bit more about that. What did that look like?
Yeah, so it's a technique that I used to use often with other women in social work. So it's around, there's a thing called worry time. So you actually literally have to, this is if you like, it's getting on top of you. You allocate yourself an amount of time and that's the time you're allowed to worry. So you can literally clock it if you want. I would say, you know, in the shower, I'm going to think about all of the worst case scenarios and all of the things that I'm worried about. But then when I get out of the shower, I can't do it anymore. So like there's a rule for yourself, or perhaps something you might say to yourself. So every time I think the sentence, like my self-talk is, what if, I'm going to sort of challenge. So it's a little bit of CBT, I guess, like challenge that thought with what's the reality. So the information today is that I'm still pregnant, I'm feeling good, the scan was good, you know, there's no evidence otherwise. So it's really challenging your thoughts and then trying to contain, because I'm definitely one of those overthinkers where I'll just be like driving along and then realize, oh, I've just been ruminating on this one and not even catch yourself doing it. So it's, yeah, putting a bit of energy into noticing thoughts and putting time limits on negative ones.
I really like that. I'm totally stealing it.
Go for it. Good, good for the pandemic, actually. It's really good to, you know, what do I know right now? What's true today? I'm safe. My family's safe. You know, that kind of back to basics stuff.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I don't really love the word mindfulness because I think I feel like it's got an element of that, which is what I'm so bad at, like, staying in the moment, and it's all about, well, what, like I was just saying to my mum today, like, oh, well, I'm thinking, you know, maybe we can put Margot back into preschool at blah, 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 blah. And she's like, well, you're talking about October. I'm like, well, yeah. Like, don't ask me to stay in the moment. I can't do it. I mean, I try, and that's something that I definitely, one of the things, which I'm sure I've said on the podcast before, but it really has stuck with me when I was going through postnatal anxiety, and I would just get really churned up around, oh my God, it's starting, like this time of day, it's of late afternoon, it's starting to go into the evening. Oh my God, that means it's almost nighttime, which means that she's going to be up and it's going to be horrible and my nipples are going to be sore. And the lovely counselor on the end of the line just said to me, okay, when you're having those thoughts, you need to just stop and ask yourself, what is needed from me right now in this moment, and what do I need right now in this moment? And I was like, okay. And that's really helped in so many situations for
and
me.
That's
so,
yeah. But I agree. I personally am a little bit resistant to mindfulness, but as a practice, I love it. I think it's really useful, and I often use it as a tool, like in my work life, but in my personal life. Even the word makes
I think it's the word. I think it's the word. It's just kind of, to me, mindfulness is almost like, oh, like just akin to saying to someone, go and have a bath, which I like a bath, but it almost just feels like it's too much of a throwaway, meaningless thing now.
And you know, for me, sometimes it conjures up, it's minimizing my issue. This is a real problem. And, you know, taking a breath and having a bath isn't going to make it go away. But you know, I think we could go into like psychologically why you resist mindfulness, yeah. But I won't go there for me. But yeah, it is actually useful. And I think,
yes,
I think also giving yourself permission to be anxious. Like, I think it's important. That's why I talked about like that little bit of time. Like, it's okay. If that's in, there's no amount of, you can't just resist those thoughts all day long. Yeah. That's exhausting. Yeah. So it's that balance.
You mentioned hypnobirthing. Sounds like that was helpful in terms of the lead up. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that and any other preparation you did for birth and postpartum? Dare I ask what preparation you did?
Of course. So heaps. I'm definitely, and I think to get a handle on any anxious thoughts, that's what I did, was I planned and I prepped. And I would often say to my husband, you know, I tried not to do full worst case scenario thinking in terms of if one of us dies, but, you know, I'd say to my husband, well, in case I have a really bad tear or I have an emergency Caesar. So I bought a freezer and I just stocked it full of meals, made like a month worth of lactation cookies in case my supply was low. Like I did so much in case. Literally, and I ordered, we were on tank water then, and I ordered something like 15 tons of water in case there was a drought, which lucky there was. So I did heaps of planning and preparation for worst case scenario. And I don't know whether that was a good idea. I don't know whether I willed the worst case scenario into existence, but I did do lots of practical planning and trying to, you know, make sure everything was as easy as it could be in case I needed it postnatally. And I think that really just helped me feel like if I had that anxious thought, what if this happens, I could go, well, that's okay because I've got the meals done and mum's ready to come over and, you know, there's water in the tank.
You found a way to sort of scaffold all of those, you know, you're such a girl after my own heart. Oh my God. Yeah. It's like, let's think of all of the possible things that can go wrong and let's find a solution for it immediately.
An A, a B, a C, you know, and I'd always say, well, I hope for the best, but I'm planning for the worst. So that's what I did. I planned for the worst. And when I say worst, I put boundaries around worst. So I had, you know, I wouldn't sort of let myself, you know, you can't plan for actual worst case scenario. I was sort of saying, you know, injury or if Bub has to go to like neonatal care for a couple of days, you know, I was putting these caveats around like my worst case scenario as well to try not to go. Yeah.
Okay. So hypnobirthing generally means you're going to attempt a pretty calm, pretty quiet, pretty chilled out birth. Was that the vibe that you were aiming for?
Look, I knew that my personality type and my exposure to complicated medical births meant that I needed to, you know, I'm not exactly your prime hypnobirthing candidate, I'll say that. But I sort of immersed myself in that world, which I think is really useful for just that mental, like trusting yourself and not having a fear reaction to birth. And that part was really important in getting my mind away from the fear of intervention, sort of just trying to, you know, it's okay, I'm made to do this, many women have done this, I can be calm, and trying not to freak out, for want of a better word, and trust that, you know, it's useful pain and all of this stuff. And I particularly liked, there was like this little meditation tape that I had as part of my course. And one of the mantras was, I'm like, I'll calmly accept any path my birthing takes or something like that. And I was like, yeah, that's a good one just in case, you know, things go. So look, I think it was important for me at the time. The way that my birth went, I'm not sure that I used any of it. But it was important for me antenatally to do that.
Yeah. And that's a huge, I mean, that getting into the zone and getting the mindset is like, there's a lot of work that you have to do in pregnancy to be ready for the birth. It's not just about, you know, the day that you're giving birth.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Exactly. Yeah. And I was not fearful whilst I was, you know, until a bit later, but I wasn't fearful like when I was those days anticipating of going into labor. I was feeling calm and confident.
Good. Tell us about going into labor and how birth unfolded for you.
Wasn't really what I expected, but in a way it was. I don't know, so the things that I was most, I tried not to think, you know, they tell you in hypnobirthing, don't think about what you don't want because your brain won't hear, don't, your brain will just hear that. So I know I was a little bit fixated on tears, like really significant tearing, and intervention, like forceps and vacuum. And I was also quite fixated on avoiding an induction, because in almost all of the work I'd done, those really extreme scenarios I saw almost were always from inductions. So, you know, in my, and in hypnobirthing, they're talking about avoiding inductions because you want the lovely hormones of a natural labor. So my waters broke at 39 and something, and then I didn't go into labor. So and I tried so hard, and that's so hard because you've got this, you're this clock on you. And I'm at home trying to, you know, I'm bouncing on my ball, sniffing my Clarisage. Like, I'm trying so hard to just, and I, that was when the fires were happening. So I also was at my parents' house. I couldn't go home. So I didn't have like my, you know, little environment, but I was just, I was being so good. I was like, that doesn't matter. I set up a little space in my parents' spare room, had my tapes on. It was like 40 degrees. I'm just sweating, trying so hard. But it didn't happen, and I pushed for, I advocated for myself at the hospital, and I pushed for 48 hours rather than being induced when I went in initially to be checked. And when I was on the way to the hospital to go back after 48 hours, I'd had my first little kind of period pain, and I was very excited. I was like, yes, I've done it. I've got myself into life. So I was like so excited. But when I got there, unfortunately, it was a little bit off and on. I got sent home and back a few times because they were really busy. And that's hard in itself. And being in the car when you're that pregnant and it's hot. And unfortunately, it just, once I got there and I tried to explain, you know, I've got these little bits of cramps, it was too long. So the risk of infection, I'd sort of bought as much time as I possibly could. And so I surrendered and I said, that's okay. I've done my best. I've bounced. I've, you know, I've done everything I can. So I felt quite calm going in. And then I was induced. And
with the drip straight up? Or?
Yeah, they went straight for the drip because I was, I think I was 1 centimetre and my water had broken. So they went straight for the drip.
Yep.
And probably within 10 minutes, I was having 3 contractions every 10 minutes, and they were really, really, really strong. Everyone had warned me, so I have like query endometriosis, complicated, but I have really significant period pain. So everyone had suggested, you know, it's very similar to that. And in lots of the hypnobirthing ideas, you know, it's useful pain. It feels like period pain. It's your body doing what it needs to do. But I think when it's on the synthetic, it's very extreme. So that sort of shocked me a little bit initially, but I did what I could. I did my breathing. And then I got to a point, so I labored like that for a little while. And they discovered that my bub was, she was posterior. So it wasn't, you know, the traditional period pain, it was just my back. And it was extreme. Like I know I just say extreme, but there's no words. Like, and I think if I used the language to describe it, I would just freak everyone out. Like it felt like I was being tortured at one point. I just couldn't. And so then when it started to feel like that, I, at that point I became like afraid. So I had no, you know how you sort of try for riding the surge like a wave, and when it comes back down you take a little breath and prepare for the next one. Well, from like the start there was no break, so or maybe 4 seconds before the next contraction. So I then went with gas, and then they did another I started involuntarily pushing, so like my body started pushing. Wow. And I started apparently acting like I was in transition. So I was like being a bit weird, and I was I can't do this, and trying to push. They checked and I was 1.5 and I've been laboring for like 8 or 9 hours. So at that point I kind of lost all of the, you know, the ability to be calm and to be reasonable and to have that little break where you take a breath. And I had a really beautiful midwife. And I had a little chat with her, and I was like, realistically, how long is this going to take? Like, I'm 1.5 and this has been going for hours. And she's like, yeah, you're not having a baby today. Like, this is, and so I think at that point I was like, I just can't do this for another day. So had an epidural, which I really was not keen on because I know, you know, limits your movement. I didn't really want to labor on my back and increase my risk of tearing. So it was a big decision, but I did it because I couldn't really see another option. So I felt very informed. We did that. But I was so distressed when I got the epidural that I had like a, I don't know what it was, but I went unconscious when they were inserting it. Yeah, it was like a kind of faint, I think. I just had this moment where, I don't know if you've ever fainted, but like my vision sort of started going and I needed a break so bad that I just sort of went with it. I was like, yes, like I want to be unconscious. So that happened, which was a bit distressing. And then I had to be, it was more distressing for my husband than it was for me. And then the next is a little bit of a blur because it was then like another still 12 hours. And the epidural stopped working.
It stopped working. Did you get any relief?
Yeah, so I got a little bit of relief with the epidural, but then it started that because she started descending. Oh, they discovered she was brow presenting as well.
She had her head.
So it's quite like the widest part of her head sort of barreling its way down. Sorry, I'm forgetting the details. Oh, I forgot. You know the... Have you heard of the sterile water injections?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I had 3 of those. Mm-hmm. And they were great, but that's extreme. But for posterior births, like I know they talked about them in my hypnobirthing class and I've read about them. They are really good. They hurt a lot, like 100 yeah. wasp stings, but it's different pain to the posterior labor pain.
And then it sort of takes your mind off that pain,
yeah.
right?
I mean, it's extreme, but it feels like, you know, you're being bitten by a wasp. So you're kind of focusing on that rather than that bone sort of pain. Yeah, so where was I? The epidural stopped and, you know, some more distressed labor. I was just distressed. I think that was the hard part. And once I'd gotten myself to that point, I just found it so hard to bring myself back. And then I couldn't regulate anymore. I was just... It wasn't even what if, I was just make this stop, you know, I can't do it. So I was really distressed. And I know I had that thought in the back of my head, like, you shouldn't be this distressed. Like, this is not good. But just feeling really out of control and like I couldn't ground myself again. Eventually I was fully dilated and I could start pushing and I found pushing really hard and I was so looking forward to it because everybody says, you know, that's the satisfying bit. I could feel the contractions because the epidural had stopped. So it was like a weird combo of like, what do you call it? Got like guided pushing and also just wanting to push. Pushed for a couple of hours, which was exhausting. And it's just, I think really hard, like I had really lovely team, but I think I felt like I wasn't pushing right. You know, like I had this weird feeling like I'm doing this wrong. And that would just stress me more. So, you know, they were saying, you can do it, you know, like push, hold your legs in, one big, you know, inhale, hold your breath, push. And it was really complicated. I felt like that's too many instructions. Like I can't, how do I push? So, yeah, and I was sort of delirious. I hadn't slept for a few days when I was trying to kind of get myself into labor. So by that stage, things were pretty grim. And my bub was born. She was born brow presenting posterior and with the cord around her neck. So I was actually really lucky. They put her up on my chest. I was just like in shock. And then they gave her a little bit of help to breathe, but she could come back to me quite quickly. But meanwhile, I was hemorrhaging and it was pretty significant. They did that uterine massage. So I was sort of trying to have my like come on, baby, find the, because you know how important all of the first moments and the skin to skin and seeing if she can find the nipple. So I'm trying to do that, and they were like very heavily massaging my uterus to sort of fix the bleeding. And then all of a sudden there were like 20 or 30 people in the room, and I was trying really hard to just focus on bub. And I suspected that something was wrong because I just was still in so much pain. I know I was listening to one of the episodes the other day, and I can't remember her name, but she was saying, you know, when you're holding baby and you're thinking, oh, not, like, I won't notice the pain. I just couldn't think of anything but the pain. I was trying so hard to focus on bub, but they were putting injections in, trying to assess the situation, and it turned out I had a 4th-degree tear. Yeah, so it was the exact scenario that I thought, that's not what I want to happen. But they sort of started the repair process, and then they realized that it was so significant. It had torn part of my bowel, so I had to go to theater. Oh. Yeah, I know. So, but in a weird way, like, that moment for me wasn't the traumatizing part. That moment I was like, I thought so. Like, that hurts so much. That, like, I just felt like, of course I've been torn, like, that pain, how could I not have, you know, you can't. And I've heard women who don't tear say, like, it's hard to imagine being in that much pain and not have an injury. So then I was taken to theatre, which I actually felt really calm about, because I knew that, well, firstly, I got to go into general, which I was like, I just need a minute. But I knew that they'd repair, you know, to the best of their ability. But I think the thing that freaked me out was some of the cases, or some of the women I had worked with that had significant tears, there's lots of complications that can happen, like fistulas and like lifelong fecal incontinence and just like significant lifelong stuff. So of course that was in the back of my mind. And my poor husband, I got raced off when he was left with bub, which in my head I'm going, oh, this is lovely. They'll get to bond. Take your shirt off, honey, and do some skin to skin. And he's just like, where are you going? What's just happened? So yeah, it was all a bit crazy right at the beginning, but bub was fine, which is nice. So that kind of took away a big part of my fear. So like knowing that she was fine and she was breathing, I was thinking, it's okay. The worst thing's happened to me, but I'm going to get fixed and she's all right. So it was kind of a bit, my mind kind of went a bit clinical at that point. Like I wasn't in that sort of glowy, like, oh, baby, and this is so beautiful and I forget everything. I was like, what have I got to do? Okay, babies with my husband. I'm going to go get fixed, you know, one thing at a time. Had that kind of medical brain, and I'm asking the doctor, like, does it seem like there's a tear in this part? And what do you think the chances of this are? And yeah, so I became a little bit clinical once the injury had been discovered.
Survival mode, sounds like.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Oh my God, that sounds so full on. I'm sorry. That sounds fucking awful. I had some understanding because I also, you know, was induced Syntocin and posterior. So I have an understanding of that, but
it's really, really intense.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, so how did you pull up after the surgery and what happened from there?
So after that, it was, you know, I sort of stayed in that clinical mindset for a little bit. To be honest, like, I think looking back, that I've never felt so vulnerable in my whole life. And I think that's probably part of that new mum experience. That wasn't sort of specifically because of the tear. But I couldn't move. I couldn't sit. And so I was having Clexane. I wasn't allowed to really mobilize. Partners weren't allowed to stay in the hospital I was in, and I was in a shared room. And so, yeah, I couldn't, so I couldn't move to get bub out of the little thing. And sort of slowly after, so I definitely had, looking back, like a trauma response. So I was in survival mode. I wasn't sleeping. I was obsessed at that point with wanting to preserve my connection with the baby. So I was sort of saying, you know, in my head, well, what's really important now that you've had this traumatic birth is that you do lots of skin to skin and you do lots of connecting with Barb to make sure, you know, I'm social working myself. And that part of it was actually fine. I did feel really connected to her, but very disconnected from myself and sort of what else was happening around me. And I didn't sleep, I think, for 4 or 5 days.
On top of the pre-labor, not sleeping.
Yeah, because as I, you know how you described before that feeling of the evening setting in? Well, all night, I think coming out of general anesthetic as well, I was just in a weird state. Like I couldn't really remember anything anyone was telling me and I was really fixated on the tear and caring for baby. So I'm saying baby because at that point I hadn't named her. So I was just saying baby. And so I was holding her and trying to feed her laying. I was sideline because I couldn't sit, but I was very scared to fall asleep co-sleeping with her because I hadn't slept and I'd been under general. So I was like, since, you know, and so I just stayed awake. And in my head I was going, well, you're a new mother. New mums don't sleep. You know, it was weird. I just would not sleep for days. And, you know, I think I would hid a little bit from the nurses and the midwives. They'd come visit and they'd be like, you're like, you seem to be doing okay. And I'm like, I'm fine, you know, but absolutely was not. And I just kept repeating to everyone that walked in the room, I wanted a debrief about the surgery. And apparently I'd had it, but like, I didn't know. I kept asking every professional that walked in, regardless of what team they were from. I remember the woman from the epidural team came to check my epidural site and I just kept saying, so how many stitches and how was the repair? And like, she's like, I just want to check the epidural site. Like, calm down. But yes, I was fixated on that and it all kind of came crashing down once I got home. And I was, like I said before, I was living out on a property, which was really nice, but there was lots of complications for recovery. So lots of stairs, lots of hills, tank water, which isn't sanitary, so no good for a tear.
So what did you do?
I had to rig up. My dad helped me rig up a camping shower hose with bought filtered water. So that's how I had to shower. And it was cold. Yeah. And the power went out and we got flooded in. And so just lots of like circumstantial stuff. But definitely I think I developed a bit of PTSD. So I was having like flashbacks and having like weird nightmares about the surgery, because I think like, you know, when you're getting put under and stuff like that. So I was not in good space and I knew that from my social work experience. So I learned a really big lesson in just asking for what you need, even if it's really weird and even if you feel really shit about it. So I had my mum come over, like I had my dad rig up, we called it like the camping bidet because there was like, you know, no alternative. I remember when I don't know how many days it was that I hadn't slept, but I'd started really panicking about Bub. I'd started thinking, well, if that can happen to me, what's to prevent something from happening to her? Like I had no way anymore to convince myself things would be okay. So I was doing lots of worry around, is she breathing? Is that safe? Like, and waking her up because I was like, is she breathing okay? So I ended up asking my mum, I remember, to sit with her so I could sleep. And I said to mum, you cannot look away from her. Like, mum got food and water. And I was like, you promise me you won't look away from her. And she was like the only person I trusted to, like my husband I would have, but he was as sleep deprived as me. So I had my mum sit in front of the baby for like 4 or 5 hours so that I could sleep and just promise not to like blink an eyelid, which is, you know, now that I look back, clearly, you know, not rational or reasonable, but like I'm really glad that I asked her to do that because at the time that's what I needed to sleep. Like there was no amount of reason that was going to convince me that she would be okay. So Yeah, big lesson in help.
And once you're in that sleep deprived zone as well, you just have to get the sleep in order to be able to, you know, have the reason.
I couldn't be rational without any more sleep. Like, I just knew that I need sleep. But, you know, and the irony is that knowing about PTSD, knowing about trauma, and knowing about what women go through when they have significant injuries, none of that protected me from feeling it, which I didn't think it would, but it didn't really help at all. Like, I still had to struggle through it. I still had to ask for the help. I still had to feel like crap, feeling so vulnerable and not being able to walk. And yeah, it's no good. It's pretty, it's pretty grim.
How is breastfeeding going for you?
Actually, quite well. Very lucky. I'd prepared for that to be difficult, but I think I'm just really lucky that my daughter is a ferocious feeder. Like, she will suck on a sock if you put it in her mouth. Like, she just had a great latch and my supply was okay. And I was doing a lot of side lying, which worked really well for us. And I think because I was bed bound, it was all I could do. So I couldn't change her or burp her or do much of the other cares for her. So I guess, like, that was kind of empowering for me, is like, I can feed her, like, I can just lay here and feed. Like, there were still issues as, like, a new mum just figuring it out, but yeah, she put on weight, and at least that part of it, she was really good, actually. I'm really lucky that she was such an easy baby for the first few weeks, because I was not coping very well.
Side note, everyone needs to learn how to do side lying feeding, because it's best, and no matter whether you've got complications or not, I think, like, I'm the lactation consultant in hospital taught me how to do that, and oh my god, like, complete game changer. So if anyone's listening to this and wondering, go YouTube it. There's plenty of YouTube videos, and remember, nipple to nose, and anyway, it's the best.
It's so good. I still side like feed for nights, and when she just won't, when she's easily distracted.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did you get through that really, really difficult time? Sounds like you got some kind of immediate help to get you, you know, those blocks of sleep, but how did you then kind of get out of that?
Yeah. So I asked for help in many ways. So I ended up being my GP and speaking to the psych that I'd spoken to in pregnancy, organizing my own little debrief, joined some support groups, read as much as I needed to about what happened, saw a women's health physio, told people what happened, like, you know, with their permission to tell them exactly what happened, and not my pregnant friends, because they often weren't, you know, but just talking about it, I think, and being really honest about the fact that it threw me and that I was feeling like a bit of a mess, and just asking people for what I needed, which was a new experience for me, like, really actually accepting help was very new to me, and saying to someone, no, like, I'm not really okay, I'm not sleeping, I keep thinking about what happened, or I'm fixated on something, just being really honest about my mental health, because, you know, there's a huge range of normal, and then thrown in a legitimately traumatic experience, your reaction is going to be, you know, it's too early to sort of tell whether you have postnatal depression or anxiety, but you're still going to have an anxious or depressed or traumatized reaction to something. So I think just being really honest and asking for help was how I managed to get through it. My mum was massively helpful.
It sounds like you had some good people around you.
Yeah. And, but just letting them in, I suppose, was my lesson, because I was prepared to just do a little, like, you know, in my head, I thought, no, I don't need my mum to come stay. Like, I don't need, I'll be fine.
Yeah, I think it comes up time and again for people that I talk to, that idea of accepting help. Asking for help is even more full on for people. And I think the more you're used to being capable and coping and everything's under control, the harder it is to do that. Yeah.
Definitely. And like, I'm always telling people to ask for help. Like, that's my job. But being the person that, like, literally saying, and, you know, feeling teary on the phone and letting yourself actually cry and say, like, no, actually, I just feel so worried or so shit or so tired. Like, you know, rather than just swallowing 10 times and trying to sound like you've got it together. Like, that stuff's hard. And being that vulnerable is really hard.
It is really hard. And I think you have to, in a weird way, you have to be really strong to be really vulnerable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's almost easier. We're conditioned. We're conditioned to be like, no, I'm fine. No. It's really okay. And yeah, no, I won't, you know, go there kind of thing. But
or not
it's hard to go there.
Not say, oh, but it'll be okay in a few weeks, or, but it's all right because I know this happens to all new mums, or, you know, trying
to. It could be worse. I have a healthy baby. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's another, I think we all have a little bit of that internalized guilt around focusing on us postnatally. Like, yes, I was very lucky that I had a healthy baby, but what happened to me is separate to that. Like, and I think it's really important for all new mums to recognize that you've been through something, whether it was, you know, an injury or whether it was just childbirth in general. It's okay to be upset or to be disappointed or to be traumatized. It doesn't discount how you feel about your baby. Like, it's not being ungrateful. And I think for a lot of people, they think it is, or there's that sort of initial response from people, but your baby's, you know, your baby's fine.
Yeah.
Like, you're allowed to be upset about something and have a healthy baby.
Absolutely. It's all legitimate. I think one of the interesting ways to think about that is when you think of the mum and the baby in that mother-baby dyad way, where the kind of idea behind that is that the mother and the baby are so closely connected. I mean, you're sharing cells, you're sharing, like, you are almost one and the same person for those first couple of months. And so the idea that, oh, well, the baby's okay, so I should be okay. No, because you are kind of at that point, you're a unit. So if you're not okay, like, of course, it's great. Yes, of course, the baby, you know, fed, all those things, but how you're feeling is going to impact on the baby, you know. And I don't say that as in, oh, you should be happy and joyful all the time, but, you know, it's okay to put yourself equal to that baby and give yourself as much care as you would to that baby and ask for that care, because you are kind of one and the same at that point.
And I think separating them mentally can be really detrimental. Like, I think if you separate mum and baby and mum's not doing okay but baby is, then that's not good for mum. Like, you know, mothers can feel left behind or isolated, or like, oh, well, the baby will be fine without me because I'm the one doing, you know, all those kind of intrusive thoughts start happening. I think when we separate the well-being of mother and child, like, it's not, they are one unit, and for, you know, that baby needs, babies need their mums, and you know, if mum's not okay, that's where the energy needs to go.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you hear about it all the time. For less sort of extreme things and later motherhood, it's always that, you know, you can't pour from an empty cup. And I think that covers a lot of scenarios. I'm really pro that idea. Wow, that's a lot. How did your physical recovery go?
Yes, I'm pleased to say very well. Mostly, I think, thanks to Women's Health Physios. Aren't they amazing?
Yes, everyone needs to go and see one. You don't need to have a degree to go and see one.
Not at all. Go see one anyway. But, and even just like, you know, physios do a bit of, I think it's called like injury psychology, and they, you know, can explain things like, even, you know, if you don't have a birth injury, but, you know, the physical experience of giving birth and what happens to your body, they can explain, like, you know, because we react to our different functioning and all of that. I found all of that useful just as much as the physical stuff, like just understanding that it's okay to react the way that I did to what happened. But yeah, I think honestly it was the emotional recovery from the injury that was the issue. Physically, I did really, really well, and I'm so, so grateful that I so far don't seem to have long-term impacts, but fearing that I would was a really big one. And I'll have to, I still will be going to, like, I still have ongoing women's health physio, but that's fine because they're awesome. But yeah, it all turned out okay, but I have to have a Caesar next time if I have another bump.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there's benefits to that.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So many positive cesarean stories now. I'm like, yeah. It's totally taken the fear out of it for me.
Yeah. Oh, me too. And I think there's so much power to being able to, you know, for me, I don't have that, if I have another baby, oh my God, how could I possibly do that again? I can just say, oh, that's okay. I can have a planned situation. And I'm very pro whatever anybody needs to do to get through, and cesarean should be on the table as part of that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. Do you mind if I ask, and you don't have to answer, but was everything okay with your sex life after that?
Yeah. So a lot of women have really complicated ongoing issues with their sex life, obviously after such a significant injury, but I don't know if lucky is the right word, but all of my damage was very internal. So actually externally, the skin on the outside didn't tear, which is why it was a bit complicated for them to figure out why I was bleeding so much and where the injury was. So I think that helped. So in terms of like scar tissue and whatnot, everything's a lot deeper internally. So yeah, I'm so, so lucky in that regard. And, you know, 4 months postpartum now, like my body's starting to feel like mine again, which I think for a lot of women that doesn't happen after an injury. So I'm really grateful. Like obviously it was unlucky that it happened, but I've been lucky in my recovery.
That's really good. Because I think for anyone, when you have sex for the first time after you've had a baby, it is always a bit like, oh, how's this going to feel? And, you know, A, is it going to hurt? But also, am I going to feel normal to them, to me, you know? So I can only imagine the kind of anticipation around that.
Again, psychological, like there's just so much, I suppose just fear and I think just fear of pain is a really big one as well. Like just around any injury, whether it's sex or whether it's like toileting or whether it's, you know, it's, you often tense up and then that doesn't help with pain either when you're all tense. So I suppose you could relate that to birth as well. But just lots of that trying to get on top of your fear barrier around it. So, yeah, but the women's health physio actually are really useful in that area too. They do lots of there's lots of discussion around sex and toileting and all sorts of things that you might do again. But I suppose it just depends on like everybody. Lots of women end up with different levels of functioning after tears, which I anticipated, but I'm very lucky. I'm more conscious of my pelvic floor than I've ever been in my whole life.
So you're still on maternity leave, right?
Yeah, I'm about to go back, but just one day a week.
Okay. How do you think your experience will change the way that you work, that you relate to women?
Yeah, I have thought about that a little bit. And I think the irony is that I was already passionate about birth injuries and birth trauma and postpartum care and the fourth trimester. But I think what's changed is probably I'll talk to women a lot more around what to expect emotionally, particularly first time mums. Like I think there's a lot of talk around what to expect physically and day to day and changes in identity. But I think that anxiety and fear and just, you know, intrusive thoughts. I mean, not that I didn't talk to women about that initially, but it was part of that conversation of postnatal depression. And I, after my injury and after my labor, I've done a lot of more research just for me. But have you heard of, I think it's a book called Good Mums Have Scary Thoughts?
Yeah, I have heard of that, but I haven't read it.
Yeah, I haven't read it either, but I've seen there's comics in it. So I've seen a lot of those posted. And I think also, you know, I think her name's Alexandra Sachs, the psychiatrist. So work she does and work, I think the book, I wrote it down, Karen Kleiman, I think, wrote that book. Anyway, if you Google Good Mums Have Scary Thoughts, there's lots of normalizing of and validating of sometimes those intrusive thoughts, you know, around, like, I know you've spoken about it in earlier podcasts, those anxious thoughts of, like, what if I drop the baby, or what if, you know, that kind of stuff. So I think talking about that a lot more, because it seems now that I've had a bub and now that I'm sort of speaking in a less professional way and more personal way to other women that have had babies, it seems like almost every single mum has those thoughts on some level, like whether it's about your birth or SIDS or dropping or feeding or whatever it may be. I think that that's something that as a society we kind of don't talk about, or we pathologize if a woman is experiencing that, oh, you must have postnatal depression, you know. But I think there's a certain level of normal worrying thoughts that we might be a bit embarrassed to share, you know, that don't mean we have postnatal depression, but might mean we just need to, you know, talk about it and share it. And I think preparing new mums for that a little bit more, like thoughts you may have and when it becomes worrying and when you should think about seeking help and when you should, you know, and you should share it with a friend or you should Google the comic or, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it sounds like that's a really big silver lining, the way it's going to, you know, inform your work.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, it doesn't, I have a work hat and a me hat. So I think professionally, like, I'm still just as interested in postnatal trauma and all of that. It doesn't really change that. But very interesting that I went through it myself. And I think I will continue to really push for debriefing if somebody has a birth that was traumatic to them. And that doesn't mean that it medically has to be traumatic, because my birth was technically normal. It was unassisted. But I still found it traumatizing. So I think it's what the woman finds traumatizing and not what's medically considered traumatizing.
Yeah. How have you been going with everything that's been happening in 2020? So your daughter was born in January, bushfires, crazy bushfires, and then we've had a pandemic. What's that backdrop been like for you amid your recovery and kind of learning how to be a mum?
Yeah, it's been complicated. I kind of had an enforced postnatal staying in period anyway. I'd planned to somewhat, but the mobility kind of made that all the more important. And then I just started feeling ready to, I'd signed up for some mums groups and I was ready to start going out, and then the pandemic hit. So I've tried really hard to not let it be isolated. I think it could be really isolating. I ended up moving away from the property into town, so that's a bit easier. I've been trying really hard to embrace technology. But I'm a little bit naturally, you know, I don't love Skype over face-to-face, and I don't, you know, I've been doing postnatal yoga and trying to do mum's group on Skype, and it's hard. It's not the same, but I think still trying, like, I think it's better than not doing it at all. And trying to do texts and phone calls and trying to keep that postnatal support system happening. In one way, I'm lucky, the age of my bub, like, it's kind of Groundhog Day anyway here. But yeah, it's definitely different. And I think interestingly, I've been doing a little bit of research around, you know, when something like a pandemic happens, technically what people are experiencing is trauma and grief. And a lot of us, no matter what situation, but particularly when that's going alongside motherhood, whether it's pregnancy or postpartum, I think that, you know, it's just another significant stressor. So I think it's a particularly vulnerable group in a pandemic because we're already worrying. And then a very real worry right now is added on top of that. Sorry, I've just heard my husband and baby.
That's okay. No worries.
Yeah, so I think I've lost my track of thought. But, yeah, I think it's significant. It's significant for pregnant women and new mums. And I think we have to kind of just be kind to ourselves. Like, I have a few friends who are homeschooling and, you know, I see a lot of women posting things around how hard it is and trying to be, you know, in inverted commas, good mum or good school teacher or start a new project. And I think we all just have to do what we have to do to get through it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, from my own experience, it's like I started out being like, this is going to be great. Homeschooling, I'm going to be the best. I mean, I wasn't even homeschooling. She's four, but she's not even four. Yeah. But, you know, like we're going to garden, we're going to cook, we're going to have our daily rhythm. It's all going to be beautiful and Steiner-esque and blah, 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 blah. And now I'm here where I'm like at 3:30 every day, play school must go on and I must have 1.5 hours to myself not to be disturbed by anyone. So, you know,
the pre-pandemic rules kind of have to go out the window a bit, you know, like the strict screen time stuff, the what you think you're going to do as a parent and what you have to do in the reality of the pandemic. It's okay for it to be different. You know, we're all just trying to survive and there's no right way to survive trauma. There's no right way to do any of this. I guess we, you know, but I think one thing I think is really good and hopefully will kind of follow through after this is all over is health services being funded to be remote. So like telehealth and all free or bulk billed psychology and GPs. That's definitely something that I've been trying to utilize. And I think like for new mums, that would be really useful all the time.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, totally. Even things like just having access to mums and bubs or postnatal yoga or whatever on, like, I couldn't do any of those sorts of things because my baby would not let me. But if I could do it at home, you know, over Zoom, great. It's good to have those kind of options.
Just put it on mute while they're crying. Easy.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Kyra, for sharing your experience. And I know it's going to be helpful to so many people. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to Tales from the Fourth Trimester. I appreciate each and every one of you who listens, shares, rates and reviews and does all of those things, tells a friend, the works. If you'd like to connect with me, you can head on over to Instagram or Facebook at Cocoon by Naomi is where you can find me. You can head to my website, which is www.cocoonbynaomi.com. Thanks and see you next week.